This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good morning. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
And happy almost New Year. Happy almost New Year. It's that time of year again. We've made it through another year, survived. Tomorrow night at Jikoji, we're going to have a New Year's celebration that includes some meditation practice, potluck supper. And quite a bit of socialization, but then toward the end of the evening, we're going to do this rather unique practice called it's called Sukhavati. It's also called Sangeman. It's kind of releasing our past mistakes, letting go of, confessing, relinquishing, letting go of our throughout what we considered throughout the year to be our harmful or unskillful or unnecessary to let go of, to release our past karma of that year, we after that we enter into the new year with the ringing of 108 bells, and some people will actually be doing 108 bows, and then we. Then we party. Then we party. We say Happy New Year, and we party as usual. So that's our traditional New Year's thing, and everyone is welcome to join. In that context, today I'd like to talk a little bit about about our responsibility as human beings and to come to terms with our past mistakes. It's that time of year, and it's not an easy topic, of course, but it's something that we should look at as honestly as we can. And I'm thinking we could take a look at our errors and our mistakes and our the way that we are and how we meet them. In the Buddhist tradition, there's this what's called the threefold practice or the threefold discipline, and it includes what we did today. It includes meditation. That's one of the three ways that, and the other way is knowledge or understanding. And the third way is conduct or ethics, so how we are in relationship, how we are in the world. Traditionally, in the Buddhist path, there's every new moon and full moon. There's what's called Sangeman, or repentance. So even in the early Sangha, the early monks and the nuns would come together, and they would acknowledge their past mistakes to one another. And of course, they lived in a community and they practiced together, so they had agreements about how to live, and they had precepts about how to behave, how to receive offerings, not to kill, not to lie, and so on. And they would acknowledge that to one another. And sometimes, if the monk or nun were very new at the job, you could say they would their preceptor, their guide, would help them remember their past mistakes, which I can imagine would have been an interesting situation. But one by one, the monks and the nuns would say this unusual thing: "I'm sorry. I am sorry." And that, of course, is not easy to say. I heard a teacher say that there's three important things that we need to learn how to say to one another, and to say thoroughly and completely and with our whole heart. And they're very simple things. They're thank you, I'm sorry, and I love you. Those three things are the necessary things to say to one another, to be in complete relationship with all beings and all things. So at the end of the year, as we sort of are wrapping up this year together, I think it is appropriate for us to say I'm sorry together, to say I apologize for any way that I have harmed you, for any mistakes that I made, for my oversights, for my neglect. And we can say that to people that are very intimate to us, but we can also say it in a very broad and collective way, that to the earth, to our whole culture, to the potentiality of our life, to the expectations that our mother had for us, to all things, we can say, I'm sorry. And with that confession, we can, that confession is in a sense a release. We let go and release our past mistakes. In the Buddhist tradition, from the very beginning, the Buddha talked about attachments. And I'd like to talk this morning about what the Buddha called the four attachments. And it's a way that we can look at our lives and our responsibilities and our mistakes in the light of these four attachments. This is from the what's a little sutra called the Lion's Roar Sutra from the Mahajima Nikaya, from one of the original Pali Canon, the original teachings of the Buddha. So these four attachments are the attachment to sensual desires. Now, that's a very broad and I think easily recognizable attachment that we have to anything that comes to us from the sensory realm, taste, touch, hearing, smell, sound, we acknowledge and see the attachment that we have in the sensory realm. That's very clear, I think, to everyone. The second attachment that the Buddha talked about was the attachment to views, the attachment to having a view, to having a bias, to having a fixed, as we chanted today, having a fixed view, a view of ourselves, of the world, of preferences, to holding those, to clinging to those, to attaching to those. That's the attachment to views. The third attachment that the Buddha talked about was the attachment to rules and observations, or sometimes it's translated as precepts and practices. This might sound unusual because obviously when a community practices together, they have rules and observations, they have precepts, they have practices. But right in the middle of this, what holds the community together, you could say, in a formal sense, the Buddha is saying, that's also a area of attachment. So look at that as well. And the final attachment of these four attachments is called the attachment to the doctrine of self. It's interesting how that's phrased. It doesn't say attachment to self. It says attachment to the doctrine of self. Or we might call it the policy of self. In other words, we have constructed a doctrine, a policy, a arrangement, an elaborate construction of identity that is us. And with that attachment, we attempt to meet the world. We attempt to be in relationship. And the Buddha says, look at this attachment as well, that we are making a self. There's a quote I like from Wittgenstein, the philosopher Wittgenstein, who says, "The sense of a separate self is only a shadow cast by grammar." The sense of a separate self is only a shadow cast by grammar. There's a teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who talks about this as a tendency that we have in our way of communication, that we confirm and we reify a sense of self simply with our language. And we say, I do this, I do that, I meet you, this is mine. So the language itself is establishing that and confirming and solidifying that attachment that we have to this policy, to keep it constructed, this policy of identity of self. And he had a practice, a personal practice that he suggested that was actually changing our language so that to actually use a passive voice. So in other words, to say instead of I am going out for a walk, he would say instead, there is going out for a walk, or simply going out for a walk. Making his conversation to himself and to others a passive voice in order to dissolve that sense of self-reification, that identity, that doctrine of self. It's interesting when we look at this to say, not like the sutra said, not holding to fixed views, not holding to a view. Does it mean not to have a view at all? Or does it mean to not attach to a view, to not cling or hold to a view? Can you hold something in view but not hold a view? Can you hold a person, can you hold someone you care for in view? I mean, really see them, really see that person, and but not hold them as a view. In other words, as a fixed idea. I have often noticed that I will come to meet another person with an idea about who that person is. Of course, I've usually had past experience with that person, and I say, I know their name, and I know their attributes, and I know their manners of expressing themselves and so on. And I know, and maybe I know something about their relationship or experiences with me, the shared experiences. So in coming to meet that person, wouldn't I have a fixed view about who they were? And wouldn't I, instead of meeting that person simply as they are in that moment, wouldn't I obscure the opportunity to meet them in that pure way with my view of who they are, of what I think they are, of what they are to me, of what value they have to me, and obstruct the meeting because of my fixed view? So this end of the year reflection that we're doing is an opportunity for us to look at this tendency we have of making a doctrine of self. There's a teacher named Kalu Rinpoche who said, there is illusion and the appearance of things, but there is a reality. We are that reality. When you see that you is not a thing, is nothing. When you can rest in being that not thing, in being nothing, then you are everything. And that's all. The teachings of Buddhism involve clearly and deliberately and very pragmatically looking at what might be called the problems or the difficulties we have in being real, in being an authentic human being, in being complete. In other words, Buddhism does not say much about any sort of elevated state or any transcendental or otherworldly state. Buddhism oftentimes says things like there are three kleshas or stainings, and please look at this. The staining of attachment, aversion, and ignoring something or delusion. And another example of this is there's the five hindrances. So, and the teachings say, please look at this. Please consider this. There's the hindrancing, the obstruction of sense desires. There's the obstruction of ill will, which includes rejecting, judging, assessing, being angry. There's the hindrance of restlessness that includes worry and includes excitement or anxiousness. There's the hindrance of sloth and torpor or unwillingness to begin. And there's the hindrance of doubt or uncertainty. And there's other versions of these, what might be called these deliberate looking at these negative aspects or these problematic aspects of us. So the question arises, When we approach these, what remains after we have, for example, if we let go of ill will, if we abandon the tendency to have resentment and ill will and harsh judgment and anger toward one another, what's left? What remains? What remains in our life, in our experience? Having put aside that aspect, what remains? Now we might say, well, what's the opposite of that? It would be loving kindness. It would be gratitude. It would be caring for one another. So we can look at these aspects as, in a sense, like clearing space for whatever remains. And we can say that we can. It's almost like saying that loving kindness, if you put away ill will, that loving kindness replaces it or comes forward. That's almost too rich. You can say everything else in your life is a life without ill will, and everything else in your life, in other words, like washing the dishes, going to the bathroom, walking down the street, is an expression of a life without ill will, if ill will is put aside. It's not that it has to embody a specific aspect of what we might call love, loving kindness. It's simply life. It's simply life as it is. Whatever remains after having put aside attachment to sense desires is your life. Is your life. Whatever remains after putting aside, after releasing fixed views, is your life. Whatever remains after putting aside attachments to ways of doing things, habits, to precepts and practices, to rules and observations, having put aside those attachments, whatever remains is your life. Whatever remains after having put aside this doctrine, this tyranny, this policy of self is your life. And it's free. It's free of those hindrances, those obstructions. There's a teacher called Yun Men who pointed to this very succinctly. He said, everyone, everything, and everyone is light. Everyone is illumination. Is pure illumination, is light. So I ask you, he's talking to an assembly. Yun Men is talking to an assembly. He says, I ask you, what is that light? If you try and own it, if you try and grasp it, if you are attached to it, it will turn to darkness. So I ask you, what is that light? And he asked his whole assembly this question, and no one could answer him. And he was actually famous for answering his own questions. And so he answered for himself. He said, the light is this, the light is the kitchen counter, the light is the garden gate, the light is walking down the path. Do you understand? It's everything. It's everyday activity, just as it is. That's your light. That's the light of the self. There's a Japanese, a little Japanese term that kind of encapsulates this very well. I might mispronounce it, so maybe you can help me. Oni ga soto, fuku ga ichi. Oni ga soto, fuku ga ichi. Is that okay?
Yes, almost.
Oh, almost, almost. It means, this is kind of funny, it means when the demons, literally, it means when the demons leave, goodness appears. It sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? When the obstructions are released, when these harmful habits and tendencies are let go of, that's it. That's enough. Naturally, goodness comes forward. Is that how it? Are you understanding? How would you translate it? Is that okay? Huh? It seems pretty simple, but very naturally, if you let go of your obstructions, there is room for goodness to arise, because we are basically good. And there is goodness waiting to come forward if it's not obstructed. So, at the end of this year, as we close up this year, we can reflect on our past mistakes, our hindrances, our obstructions, our harmful words, our harm to ourselves, and with that cleansing, with that acknowledgement, and with that releasing, we can meet the new year. And remember that the new year needs us. We need to come forward, refined and cleaned. And I think we can all agree that our culture, our society is in need of these individual points of refinement and purity that we can make in ourselves and from ourselves manifest and share and broadcast. So let's do it. Let's release our ancient, twisted karma, our past mistakes, our obstructions, and come forward to a happy new year. Okay? Okay. How's our time?
10 minutes.
Okay. Would anyone like to share something or have a question or something? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like your view on the relationship between the hindrances and just delusion. There's that haunting line, when erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind realizes itself.
Yeah.
And
from the Jhulmir Samadhi?
Yeah. So as far as my relationship with myself, I'm finding that most of my imaginations are erroneous.
And we are very creative, aren't we? Yeah.
And yes, indeed. And I guess I'm trying to relate that to the five hindrances. How does that kind of work together in Buddhist philosophy and precepts?
The erroneous imagination. Well, I see it in the context of the Jhulmir Samadhi as remember, the Jhulmir Samadhi is talking about thusness, as it isness, mm-hmm. things as they are, unobstructed awareness of things as they are. So the erroneous imagination is just this. It is a view. It is a view of self and other. It is a view of birth and death. It is a view of things as they are viewed through the lens of these five hindrances, or these, or the three kleshas, or these other expressions of what is obscuring us, you know. That's all. That's as far as I can get with it. Do you have anything to add?
No, that gets pretty well. And typically these erroneous imaginations have precisely to do with my relationship with the world.
With the world, yeah.
And, so it's the view in the self.
Question comes up to how to release, you know, how to let go. I mean, a lot of these things are habituated, so we have tendencies, and so it takes some work to drop off a tendency to for instance, seek to confirm or justify ourselves in communication with how we talk about the world or others or something like that. Any kind of obstruction like that. So. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Marco. Thank you to Koji, for everybody at Koji, for doing this. And I apologize for having a hard time speaking. But when you said to change the language.
Hmm.
Todd and I were just reading something about this. People who use we or us, there's some health benefit to it. Maybe Todd wants to elaborate on this. And I love everybody. Thank you.
So did you say some health?
Health benefit. I don't know, people live longer, or maybe Todd remembers the details, but there was some study that people who use, instead of I, mm-hmm. they use a lot we and us,
mm.
there's some health benefit. They are more happy, or they are, I think it was they were more happy.
Oh, that would be interesting
yeah.
to to say.
So that came to my mind when you said that study, or when you mentioned Goldstein about changing the language.
It'd be interesting to say we. Say I was alone and I was going to wash the dishes. I was going to say, we are going to wash the dishes. I could try that. Look around. Who's with me? You know, I think I'm going to try that.
We'll get the dishes done.
Yeah. A lot of hands, yeah.
Driving up here, I was listening to Tara Brach, and she said the same thing. She said, illness, there's an I in illness. And then she said, wellness starts with W-E, as we.
That's nice.
One of the sutras talk about good and evil as the primal disease of the mind, and we also discuss non-duality and going beyond good and evil and life and death, and then the teachings also talk about not having preferences. So how do we choose to be good without having a preference? Because as soon as we say this is good, then we separate what is bad, and then we fall into this category and we develop a preference for good.
For good.
So how do we resolve this?
To have an intention or an aspiration for developing ourselves or for the good is in and of itself it's not a problem, and it's not. It's not in and of itself or even have a tendency to evil, is not in and of itself a indication of succumbing to duality. To give something attention or to give something focus is how we live and how we exist. To give that thing attention and focus, and to ignore its opposite is ignorance. What we often do in our daily life is our attention has a foreground and a background. So right now I'm looking at you and I'm paying attention to your face, and I'm ignoring or giving less attention to the whole room and the sense of other people around you, because I'm looking at you and I'm talking to you. But the practice of equanimity, the practice of that kind of balance that you're talking about, that sees through duality and sees that the foreground and the background exist together, and they're mutually in support of one another. They confirm one another, you could say. So in order to see you, although I may ignore it or not pay good attention to it, in order to see you, I need to have everyone here with you, and the room, and the trees outside, you know. In our practice, in the development of our practice and awareness, we can develop a capacity to, when we focus on something, when we bring our attention or intention to something, that we are also aware of its opposite, or its complement, you could say. The teachings of equanimity is basically not that opposites don't exist, it's that they don't contradict one another. Good and evil, birth and death, goodness and badness, you could say are mutually interdependent, and still, in the midst of accepting that duality, you can choose the good, and you do. You do choose the good, don't you?
Yeah, and that's where I get confused.
We make choices all the time, of course. We choose vanilla ice cream instead of chocolate ice cream. And some of those choices are just a question of taste. And they're not fixed views. But when they become a policy, when they become a habit, when they become a preference, then it's time for us to look at them as a kind of bias, as a fixed view, and take that on as a focus of understanding. Yeah. Big topic. That's a big topic. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one simple example when you were talking was one of those four that you had mentioned, you know, the sensual and the ego, was the customs and practices and not to get attached to them. And in a sense, the practices and sort of rules that the community has are for the good and for the health of the community. So they're oriented towards good, but they're... You don't want to get attached to
exactly.
What
you're doing.
So
exactly. Yeah.
It seems like somewhere in there, there's a kind of
middle ground, huh?
Yeah, that we do want health and goodness and things, but we don't want to get attached.
People that get very engaged in this Buddhist way and can sometimes get very attached to the forms and the practices, and or maybe these forms, they come from traditionally the yogic forms come from India, and then there's Chinese and Japanese qualities about them, as you might call them aspects. People can get very attached to those forms and miss the point. Yeah.
In my church, they get upset about translations.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of attachments, I heard a lunch bell. And is anyone attached to being hungry? shall we adjourn for lunch? Yeah. Did you have a question?
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.